Okay, welcome to this special part of Marxism with our guest speaker, Paul Adams, one of the biographers of Frank Hardy, and he's here to give us, introduce a discussion about Frank Hardy's work, and so we're very pleased to have him. And without further ado, I'm going to hand over to you to begin your discussion.
Thanks very much. Look, it's really great to be able to come to a venue like this and talk about Frank Hardy and also Power That Glory, basically because I think some of this history, even though there have been some efforts to recover it, is starting to be lost, and it's really important, I think, that it's continued to be talked about. I suppose I first started researching Frank Hardy probably in the early 90s, late 80s, and this was just when Frank Hardy was still alive, so I was actually able to spend quite a lot of time talking through with him about Power That Glory and the range of other things that he'd been involved. One of the things I did discover very early on with Frank Hardy, though, was that his history and the history of Power That Glory is very murky. And we're actually still starting to uncover some of that history 60 years later. Some of it still is not known. I noticed that state libraries, for example, has just put up a website, and they found yet another edition of Power That Glory that's come to light that was printed, I think it was by the Ferguson Printing Press, which was sort of done semi-illegally. I have two editions myself of the original one, but this was one that I didn't know actually existed. Pauline Armstrong's, Jenny Hocking's biographies, I'd also recommend them to you to read because they also have fantastic information in them. My biography was, I suppose, one of the first ones that was written. It was probably more orientated around talking to Frank Hardy, and I suppose being a student of literature at the time too, I was also most interested in recovering the literary Frank Hardy, but I'm going to talk about the historical Frank Hardy today. And that's part of my interest, I suppose, in working class writing and ensuring that we continue to have a tradition of working class writing, and also that people keep studying it in one form or another. I might actually pass some of these editions around, some of you might be interested in having a look. Just trying to figure out which ones. I think this is the very first edition that was published. Have a look at that. This was actually done by a proper press. Les Barnes and Vic Little were fairly instrumental in producing that one with Frank Hardy as Communist Party members. And this one is the second edition, which I believe was produced in people's homes in an underground way around Melbourne, western suburbs and the meatworks. And you can actually tell if you look at it by the very uneven pages which have been put together, which is really fantastic. So a bit of history anyway. That's great. Frank Hardy's name and the novel that he wrote, Power That Glory, he lived pretty much in the shadow of that for the rest of his life. Hardy did write other books and some very important books, such as The Unlucky Australians, which was about one of the first Aboriginal rights campaigns, land rights campaigns in Australia. It was a landmark campaign. Even Gough Whitlam acknowledged the significance of it. The Gurindji were one of the first people to get land rights in Australia. So Frank Hardy was certainly involved in a range of other things, as was the Communist Party with him, than just Power That Glory. But it's still the novel that he's very much still remembered. Oddly, a novel that was published 61 years ago, so it's quite a lot of distance. I think because of its huge public impact from the period, we still hear the faint echoes and ripples today from the period. For those of us growing up in the 1970s, like myself, you will remember the 1976 ABC television series, which really gave Hardy's Power That Glory a kind of a second life, and people remember that series quite fondly and eagerly tuning into it. I think it was on a Saturday night to watch it. Again, watching it with revelations that what we were actually watching was Melbourne's real history, but in fact it was a fictional work. Even today, people think that Caring Bush was Collingwood's original real name. Guess what? It was an invention of Frank Hardy. In the 1990s, Hardy also had a bit of a brief revival in academic discussion, and it was certainly when I started writing my own biography. There was a lot of books and journal articles published, and for a while, Hardy became the pin-up person for postmodernist discussion, despite Hardy's own antipathy to post-structuralist thought. Hardy wrote a really interesting article which he submitted to The Age just before his death in 1994. It was actually a couple of days. I actually had to talk to him before he'd written it up. But interestingly, in this article, which was about postmodernism, The Age at first rejected it outright, would not publish it, said it was far too political and academic and they would never publish anything like that. And he died, and guess what? They published it after his death. But in the article, he remonstrated with Professor John Frau, who's a professor at this university, I think, still, that he should go beyond using his novels as a case in point for the postmodernist milieu. He noted further that the study of literature had become essentially a middle-class minority affair. Readers after leaving school turned to popular writers like Wilbur Smith and Colleen McCulloch, who were despised by the literary elite almost as much as Lawson, Morrison, John Morrison, another working-class writer who's almost been forgotten, and Hardy. I think Hardy was actually onto something. Interestingly, in a survey conducted by the Australia Council 6 years later, this was just with a general sample, the general Australian population, they found that 30% of Australian people found the arts had little or no role in their lives, with most of those indicating that art was an elite activity, irrelevant and often pretentious. Hardy's view, I think, of literature was that it always should be popular, or at least you should attempt to make it popular. He published in the Post magazine and received quite a bit of flack for doing that, but certainly, if you remember getting a haircut in the 80s or 90s, you could regularly read Frank Hardy while waiting for your haircut by reading the Post. He was also obviously keen to be on television and was on a number of ABC television series. He was, for most of his life, and probably up until the 90s, fairly much neglected and indeed dismissed by the key literary institutions in the universities and in Australia. Hardy was a great synthesiser of popular history and culture, and we should be perhaps grateful to him for his legacy of Power That Glory, which has kept alive an older people's history, which would have completely disappeared, about the inner city of Melbourne. And if Hardy did nothing else, he recorded that history in a fictional way, and we still have a record of it. Power That Glory itself is a sprawling gobstopper of a novel. It was written probably at the time when people used to listen to radio for entertainment, 10 street meetings. It was meant to be read over a long time because that's what people wanted. I teach a subject at my own university called working class writing, which by the way is the only unit of its type in Australia, but I would find it very difficult getting most of my students to read a 1,000 page novel nowadays. 200's about the limit. But certainly at the time, it was something that people would read and something that they liked reading. It's the history of the Melbourne trotting magnate John West, ALP manipulator, based on the real historical figure of John Wren and his rise to power on the basis of corrupt control of local government, Victoria Parliament and the racing industry. Hardy's view about West Wren is expansive, and indeed, reading the book, we would think that John Wren controlled, in fact, most of Australia from the book. Hardy's pains in the book to argue that, in fact, monopoly capital still controls Parliament by remote control, but certainly if we're looking for political influence at the time, the book would suggest that Wren controlled the whole of Australia. Yet, again, we don't know a lot about Wren today and his activities, although there's been a number of histories written on him. We do know things about him, but we certainly don't know the sorts of, I suppose, outline that Ahadi was putting in the book about Wren. And that's possibly because of the people's history nature of Power That Glory. Hardy got some of his books from learned historical sources, but he also got a great deal of his information from talking to people around Fitzroy, Collingwood, Richmond, in the pubs. And a lot of it, I think, is in the category of oral people's history, which, again, probably wouldn't have seen the light of day and been for Frank Hardy. Pauline Armstrong, I'd probably say, is Hardy's most hostile biographer. I mean, she's certainly, I think, it's an excellent book if you want information about Power That Glory, but she's certainly, I would say, Hardy's most hostile biographer. Says that Power That Glory was essentially a communist plot. She says, there is strong evidence to suggest that Power That Glory was the brainchild of some members of the executive of the Victorian branch of the CPA. She then goes on to suggest that this project was delivered to Frank Hardy and that he went on to write the book. I think there's no doubt, as Jenny Hocking suggests in the most recent biography of Hardy, that there was an intersection of interests of the CPA executive with Hardy's interest in writing the book. John Wren, upon who the book was based, was a key extra-parliamentary leader of the Catholic Right in the ALP. The CPA leadership at the time was preparing for war against the ALP and particularly its Catholic Right, who were seen as the local representatives of fascism. With the onset of the Cold War and the rise of Bob Santa Maria's industrial groups, which were fighting a mortal battle with the CPA and the unions for the hearts and minds of the rank and file, the Catholic Right of the ALP was seen as the chief target of the CP. It was quite well-established history. Wren was not closely aligned with the new industrial groups, which had come through the Catholic social studies groups and the movement in Santa Maria, but he was nonetheless seen in Victoria by the CP as a key political foe and opposed to Communist Party objectives. Hardy's own account in interviews I have, though, suggests a slightly different version to Armstrong's. Hardy acknowledges the prior work and contributions that Ralph Gibson, Les Barn, Deirdre Moore made in taking on the mammoth task of collecting research for the book. Also notes, Ralph Gibson's important role as a member of the executive of the Communist Party and being an advocate for the book. But he also notes that Gibson had first asked him to write a political pamphlet about John Wren, not a novel. Hardy demurred that he wanted to write a novel because he wanted to be a writer. Hardy had been active in the realist writers' groups before this time, but this was also certainly an ambition he held. Gibson eventually agreed and went on to argue to a largely, and Hardy, this is Hardy's words, disinterested state executive of the Communist Party, that Hardy's project was worthy of support. Maybe, as Armstrong herself notes, that Hardy then used Ralph Gibson's name, which was prestigious in the Communist Party at the time, to later attract support and volunteers for the project. Whatever the sequence of events, as has been well documented elsewhere, there is still little doubt that the leadership of the Communist Party at this time would have been largely disinterested in the idea of a communist writing a literary book. My guess is that they would have needed substantive convincing by Gibson. Hardy also notes in an interview that he had a long interest in Wren prior to the meeting with Ralph Gibson, mostly due to his father, Tom Hardy. Again, if you want to read about some of Hardy's early background, which is, again, greatly exaggerated and fictionalised, you might want to have a look at Legends of Benson's Valley, which is about his time growing up in Bacchus March. Among some of the claims that he makes there was that his father, Tom Hardy, was a militant member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and if you believed everything that was happening in the book, Tom Hardy was constantly a terror of the local constabulary and threatening to burn down the town. I did actually go out to Bacchus Marsh and interview some of Tom Hardy's contemporaries, and what I did discover was that Tom was quite a quiet bloke who tested milk. But he did tell very exaggerated political yarns, and people remembered that. And yes, he did have militant ideas. Again, some of this is disputed, and as I said, the more you get into Hardy, the more you realise that the sources and evidence are quite murky. But Tom Hardy had evidently said to Frank before he'd come to Melbourne, when I think his brother Jim had talked about joining the Labor Party, "It's not a Labor Party. John Wren owns it lock, stock and fucking barrel. He owns the printery, the headquarters, the buildings, everything. Join it if you like, but don't think you're joining the Workers' Party, because you're not. So when I arrived in Melbourne," this is Hardy from the Bush, "I thought John Wren was more powerful than BHP." Hardy's own take on Wren was that perhaps at the time more extravagant than the Communist Party's own. And this does, I think, come in out in the book somewhat, as I've said. "It's no doubt the party was hostile to Wren, but the representation of Wren in Power That Glory is perhaps even more exaggerated than the party's own. Wren West rises to power and political influence in the book, stops only just short of full control of the Australian Federal Parliament. The criminal world in Melbourne also meshes with John Wren in a way which has some truth, but it is clearly exaggerated. And as I said, the novel's about 60% fact only. I think, therefore, at least from my point of view, and again, it's probably because I'm more interested in stories and literature, what this tends to show that was that Hardy had much more agency in the development of his own novel than is perhaps argued for by Armstrong. Although Armstrong, I think, does concede, and quite rightly, that Hardy actually wrote the book, and this is actually important, he wrote it. And it was not written by the Communist Party, unlike other critics who have argued otherwise. If any of you get the chance to go up to Canberra and have a look at Frank Hardy's archives, you can actually see the full manuscript in his own hand. So someone was either telling him how to write over his shoulder, or they were very good imitators of his handwriting. The book was written between 1946 and 1950. Hardy had rented a room at 255A Bridge Road, Richmond, between 1947 and 1948, and adopted the pseudonym Frank Rice. From there he would enter the streets of Richmond, Fitzroy and Collingwood clandestinely and seek out informants who might be able to tell him more about Wren. He met people who were cooks and people who had worked with the Wren family who lived around the area. He did interviews and made contacts with people from the Wren machine, people like Con Loughan, Labor number man and numbers man, next mayor of Richmond Council. Ex-mayor of Collingwood, Robert Sugar Roberts, who appears in the novel, as does Loughan, who had by that time been expelled from the Labor Party for nefarious activities, mainly, I think, against, might have been Maurice Blackburn, who told Hardy about Wren's political rackets, branch stacking and control of local councils. Through Ralph Gibson and journalist Ian Aird, who was a Communist Party member, Ken Miller, editor of The Guardian, he also found out about the Wren family. He joined the Trotting Association, surprise, surprise. Hardy, being a gambler for most of his life, indeed a problem gambler, certainly had huge contacts in those areas, but joined in the fight against Wren, who at that time was trying to shut down racetracks and take them over. He was able to uncover much of the Wren's empire in racing. Les Barnes, Communist Party member, helped him print the book, also introduced Hardy to Harriet Middlecote, who was Labor Party member Frank Anstey's mistress, who was able to tell Frank a lot about Anstey's contacts with Wren. It does get very murky, though, and it's very interesting that even the later biographies than my own still struggle with some of Hardy's sources, and this is why much of his book still remains a bit of a mystery. And we're talking to Frank, 94-95, and much of this remained a mystery to him, because some of his sources, he was very unsure about their credibility. There was an interesting man he met called Alan Hall, who I find a very interesting figure in Australian history, and perhaps more should be written about him. But Alan Hall was a contact that Hardy wrote about in a book called Who Shot George Kirkland, which was published around about 1983. When I talked to Hardy in the 90s, I mean, most people at the time were regarding this book as a book of fiction. It's a book of fiction. It's a rewriting of Power That Glory, and it's a fictional work about Power That Glory. For what it's worth, Frank Hardy told me it was the truest book that he ever wrote about anything. I must say I did take that with a pinch of salt at the time. However, the book does go into detail, significant detail, about Alan Hall. Alan Hall claimed to be the brother-in-law of a bricklayer named Bill Egan. Bill Egan had been working evidently around at the Wren's house. Alan Hall told Frank Hardy that Bill Egan had had an affair with John Wren's wife, Ellen Wren, which had produced an illegitimate offspring. Who Shot George Kirkland is a very interesting book, and even when I talked to Hardy about this, he was also very doubtful about Alan Hall. He remained doubtful about the information he'd got from Hall. Hall had actually told him at one time that he was a security agent working possibly for Commonwealth Security. Hardy had deep suspicions about that in any case, but he wondered whether Hall had been put in his path as a plant from the Wren machine to provide him with false information. As people may know, Hardy was later charged with criminal libel for depicting Alan Wren for having this affair and having Xavier, her illegitimate child. So there is quite a conspiracy theory that can be whipped up around the novel if you're prepared to go down that path. Hardy was, I think, concerned about putting this particular story in his book. But on the advice of Communist leader J.B. Miles, who was on the Communist Party Central Committee at that time, nationally, he decided to put the incident in the book. Although, as Jenny Hocking, I think, suggests, and this is probably the thing that she's done most with her biography, the inferred allegation in the book against the child Xavier, who was indeed a child of the Wren family, but had already died, was probably the wrong person. According to Hocking, and I think she's probably right, the real story is about a child called Angela Wren. And it appears that Hardy changed the name in the book, perhaps to protect Angela. Because if you go to the archives, there was a tremendous discussion within the CP at this time about whether this incident should be published, even though it was a very small part of the book, essentially because it involved innocence. I suppose whatever Hardy's intention, this particular incident, though occupying only a very small part of the novel, would land Hardy in very serious hot water. Hardy was fully aware, not just because of this incident, but because the book actually detailed all of Wren's corruption through Australia, his connection with politicians, bribery, murders, and so forth, that the book was very likely to be met with bans, libels, suits and injunctions, and in fact it put out a prospectus before the publication of the novel to make people aware of this and to seek investment. Remembering also this is 1950, the novel's coming out in the middle of the Cold War, or the start of the Cold War. You know, at this time we had attempts to ban the Communist Party of Australia. We had people being arrested, others being dismissed from the Peace Council just for being on the Peace Council, not being communists. But it was a time of communist witch hunts. Rosenbergs in the United States, of course, at this time had been executed for trading atomic secrets. So it was a very serious period, and it was a period, I suppose, when party and indeed the Communist Party could expect the full force of the law laying against them. Publication of the book was the first consideration. No publisher could be found to publish the book. Communist Party came in to assist publication. There are many people who helped with the publication. I probably can't list them all here. Some of the key people: Communist Vic Little, who was the printer; Les Barnes, was the compositor, both of who were working with the secretary of the Butchers' Union, George Seelaff, at the time. Between them, they were able to print about 8,000 copies of the first edition, so the one circulating around is probably one of those. Printing at some stages, because printing did begin in 1949, even though the book didn't come out to that, was only just ahead of writing some of the chapters of the novel. So you can imagine some of the frenetic pace in which the book was being put together. The fact that we don't actually know how many editions of the book actually came out and who did them, I think also indicates the frenetic pace in which this was actually put together. There were all kinds of people trying to get this book out because it was being suppressed. By the publication of the second edition, Hardy was arrested and ordered not to distribute or print the book as part of his bail conditions. George Seelaff from the Butchers' Union took over management and distribution of this edition. The 55 printers approached, only 5 could be found who would take the work. Metal type was moved from place to place, binding and backing down in the houses of trade unionists and party workers. Vic Little trained people around Melbourne to do the binding and production of the book by hand in lounge rooms around Melbourne, and became one of the mammoth tasks of production of an illegal work that's pretty much gone down in legend in Australian history. And of the people who helped produce this book, many of them will talk about it quite fondly. However, Hardy by this stage had been charged by the Wren family with criminal libel. Criminal libel is still on the Australian law books, but it's very infrequently used. The reason why is it's an anachronism. Particularly at this time, you couldn't use truth as a defence. You had to prove that you weren't about to cause civil unrest. How hard's that for Hardy in the middle of the Cold War, having produced a book about the Wren family? Pretty bloody hard. The other aspect of the law of criminal libel was, because it wasn't a civil charge, in other words, it was part of the criminal code, it was not eventually the Wren family who prosecuted Hardy, even though they initiated the charge. It was the government of Victoria and the Attorney General's Department. So there was a direct political relationship to this charge of libel that went further than Alan Wren. The charge alleged that Hardy had criminally libelled Alan Wren by suggesting in his book that Mrs. Wren had committed adultery and had an illegitimate child named Xavier. She had seduced a married man, and she had falsely represented herself, or allowed herself to be represented, of the wife of the man concerned. Under civil libel, Wren could only claim for financial compensation and place injunctions on further publication of the book. But criminal libel allowed the prosecution, the government, to seek imprisonment with no limit upon the length of the jail sentence. Truth could not be used as a defence. Even if Hardy could show that Alan Wren had slept with a married man, this had no bearing at all on the case. Hardy needed to demonstrate that his book had not breached the public peace. A very difficult task for a communist at the height of the Cold War. He could also perhaps expect the legal system to deal harshly with a communist agitator. Before publication of the book, a string of communists had been jailed on sedition charges, including the secretary of the Communist Party, Lance Sharkey. By 1950, the law was an anachronism. The law dated back to 1295, when it had been used by the Stuarts to suppress writing which might cause sedition or great peril and mischief to come to the realm. It had been used to imprison Daniel Defoe, the author of Robinson Crusoe, and John Wycliffe, the translator of the Bible into English, who had advocated the redistribution of church lands to the peasants. Naughty, naughty. Legal expenses of up to £200 per day and bail costs also had to be found, accumulating to a total greater than £2,450 by the end of the court case, a huge sum in 1950 which could purchase a five-bedroom brick house in many places in Australia. Six days after Hardy was arrested, a group of left-wing writers, including C.B. Christensen, Alan Marshall, Brian Fitzpatrick, some of these names have been probably forgotten now, but nonetheless famous writers at the time, Eric Lambert, John Morrison, sent out a letter to trade unions, writers' organisations and cultural groups proposing to establish a committee for the defence of Mr. Hardy. The meeting adopted a three-point program. One, to raise sufficient money for a legal defence. Two, to explain the issues involved in criminal libel, particularly the threat to freedom of expression and literary creation, and three, the explanation of these issues and agitation about them to have the charges withdrawn. The achievement of these objectives, laudable as they were, however, proved to be a very formidable task for the Frank Hardy Defence Committee. Few public spaces were available to left-wing activists. Interestingly, Melbourne University, where we are now, was one of the spaces that was available, but there weren't that many others. The newly formed executives spoke increasingly of a frustration of a wall of silence which was being built around the things they were trying to do. They couldn't find a hall to hire. Five letters of request were sent to the town clerk of Melbourne and one to the Lord Mayor of the City of Melbourne requesting hire of Melbourne Town Hall. Melbourne Town Hall was refused. The dailies, newspapers, failed to accept Frank Hardy Defence Committee's paid advertisements and press releases of the committee, but publicised widely the attacks by politicians on the novel. Predictably, only the left-wing newspapers, The Liberty, The Guardian, trade union journals and so on, Council of Civil Liberties, were prepared to take the publicity of the Frank Hardy Defence Committee. In Sydney, police even stopped the Frank Hardy Defence Committee from selling one of Hardy's book of short stories, The Man from Klinkerpella and Other Stories, which hadn't been banned and was simply short stories, essentially, in the Sydney Domain on May Day. And escorted two members of the committee off to the police depot, despite protestations from the people being walked off that this book was for sale in many bookshops in New South Wales and had in fact been authorised for sale by the New South Wales Police Commissioner himself. Despite these stumbling blocks, however, the Frank Hardy Defence Committee managed to win over the public opinion through a mixture of cunning and sheer effort. They resorted to subterfuge, applying for halls through friendly unions or applied without listing Frank Hardy as one of the speakers. They took the campaign to public spaces available to them, particularly workplaces, the streets, private houses, trade union halls, the countryside, the Yarra Bank and Melbourne University. Of the 36 meetings, or almost one a day for the month of November, Hardy spoke at 21 and his wife Rosalind at 6. As the campaign extended into 1951, the campaign accelerated and meetings became larger. Lunchtime work meetings attracted up to 600 workers. Hardy crossed the country speaking in Wonthaggi, Sydney, Newcastle, and the meetings of over 300 in Ipswich and Brisbane. By the end of the campaign, over 6,000 people had passed motions demanding that the prosecution be withdrawn. In less than 8 months, the committee had held over 220 functions, 60 in private homes, 60 in trade union halls and public halls, 140 in factory and job and union meetings. The committee sent out over 3,000 written appeals for money, distributed in excess of 30,000 leaflets and provided regular reports to the daily press and trade union journals. On May Day 1951 in Melbourne, the committee entered two floats which travelled in the May Day march, one which demanded with a demand for a royal commission into corrupt politics and another with a gunman and a big business magnate pointing to a copy of Power That Glory. On June 12, 1951, the campaign culminated in Hardy's appearance before Justice Martin and a jury in the Melbourne Supreme Court. After legal argument, Justice Martin removed the need for the prosecution to prove the most controversial aspect of the charge of criminal libel. He removed the breach of the peace clause, which would have required Hardy's lawyers essentially to make a defence that Hardy was not a revolutionary communist and was not attempting to breach the peace. But this still left a number of limited arguments upon which the defence could be mounted. However, this would also be a critical flaw for the Wren family because truth could not be used either as a means of defence or prosecution. The defence was, or possible means of defence, was first that Hardy had not written and published the book, but I guess he was gone there. Second, that the real Alan Wren was not the equivalent of the composite fictional Nellie West of the book. And third, that the good character of Alan Wren had not been defined. Sensing that grounds other than legal ones were needed to fight the case, wisely advised his lawyers to read out long extracts of the book in court. And this is a tactic that's actually been used in the American Senate a couple of times. But essentially what this did was it enabled publication of the book because the dailies reported on it. They could also not be sued for libel because the court is a privileged arena, and once it's in a courtroom, unless the judge has made an order, you can publish it, and that's what the newspapers did. Finally, the book was getting read in a very mainstream way by a whole range of people. Extracts were circulated in the daily newspaper, and long extracts were read out in court. After a six-day trial, the jury eventually found Hardy not guilty. It appears not only because they agreed with legal arguments which stressed Nellie West's composite fictionality and depiction in the book as a good woman, but also the defence's exposure to the jury of the anti-democratic character of the criminal libel charge, and John Wren's failure to lay a charge in his own right of libel, which was very important at the time. Because if anyone had been defamed in the book, it had been him, not his wife. Ironically, by ensuring the truth, because it wasn't an issue in the court case, the Wren family did Power That Glory service that they probably didn't intend to do. Power That Glory has now gone down in history as the true and complete biography of John Wren. And you can see this if you follow the newspapers. You know, as I said, 1976, when the television series came out, it was presented as history. Indeed, a lot of Hardy's critics argue with the book on the basis as if it's a real historical account, never written like that. So is Power That Glory the great Australian working class novel? That's what I've been asked to come and talk to you about today. I think the answer is probably yes, just in terms of sheer public and lasting impact. Although I think its memory after 60 years now is becoming a little fainter than what it was. Could the conditions which produced Power That Glory be produced again? I think the conditions were historically unique. We'd have trouble producing a similar kind of effort again. But I think there are things which can be learnt from Power That Glory, and I think there are some important legacies of the novel. I think one of the things that Power That Glory did show, and I agree with Hardy that I think the leadership of the party was largely disinterested in literature up to this point, so that literature and culture could have broad political effects on audiences and reach them in a way which political rhetoric and left-wing pedagogy could not. Culture perhaps still remains an underutilised area of political contestation by left-wing and progressive forces. The political working class literature could be popular and successful was another thing, I think, that Power Thou, Glory found. And I think Hardy's lament at the end of his life that working class writers such as John Morrison had been forgotten and their memory needed to be restored is an important point to make. There are few publishers in Australia today who are prepared to publish working class writing. There are contemporary working class writers, but they face enormous difficulty in getting published. Most of the literary magazines in Australia, including many of the so-called left-wing ones, are overwhelmingly hostile to working-class writing. And it perhaps remains, I think, a continuing challenge for both working-class critics in the area or critics of working-class writing and working-class writers themselves to get publication. Perhaps not uncoincidentally, one of the chief legacies, I think, of Pale That Glory was to pioneer alternative publishing. There's no doubt that most of the alternative publishers that we have today owe a huge debt to Power That Glory. They would not be here without Power That Glory. Why? Because one of the important offshoots of the Power That Glory campaign was the first left-wing publishing house, the Australasian Book Society. Australasian Book Society pioneered alternative publishing in this country and at one time was responsible for up to a quarter or a third of all publications of Australian writing in Australia. Why? Because most of our publication happened or came from England. There was very little publication of Australian writing. So we owe a huge debt to Power That Glory for that legacy. Perhaps another legacy of the book also is that Power That Glory assisted in its own way, I think, prevented Australia moving towards an totalitarian state. During the 1950s, and for people who lived through it, they will tell you, the intent of the Menzies government was quite clear. It wanted to not only ban the Communist Party, but it was also quite interested in declaring a range of other political undesirables and oppositionists as communists. We now also know that the Menzies government intended to establish internment camps. There's no doubt that Frank Hardy would have been in one of them, possibly reading extracts from his novel. Power That Glory, I think, merged with the general campaign at the time for free speech and against the anti-democratic actions that were happening. And we do owe the people from that time a huge legacy for not becoming the kind of totalitarian state that exists in some other countries. I think significantly too, in a more contemporary sense, Hardy showed that in times of adversity, it was important to take bold risks, which even though they would attract persecution, could create social change. Persistence remains a powerful weapon, and I'm sure if Hardy was still alive today, he would be, you know, certainly cheering on many people, such as WikiLeaks and other people on the internet who are now trying to publish sensitive materials and information which everyone should have the right to see. And perhaps if there's anywhere where the tradition of Power That Glory exists still, in a contemporary sense, it's in these campaigns. That's all I've got to say. Any questions?